London Calling. David here. Got Adam on the other end of the line. He and I have got a fair bit in common. We're both incomers. Big difference, though. I'm an American, and Adam's a Scot. We're both, well, ex-journalists. We're obsessed with London. And a phrase that's been, it's become current in the last year or so is this phrase, reading the room. And it's occurred to me that when you're what I am, an American who's transplanted himself to a foreign country for no matter how many years, you always read the room, or you often read the room a little bit imperfectly. Now, sort of with an accent, as it were. But I've surrounded myself with some people who help me with this. They're native Britons, and a really important one is this guy here, Adam. So when I've got questions, or even things that just amuse me, I often get in touch with Adam, and I want to find out what he's got to say about him. So I was doing some reading the other day, and in the 18th century, and they had something called the Gordon Riots, which were anti-Catholic riots, and George Gordon was, I think, of Scottish extraction, and the author said he was charming, articulate, and intense, but the Gordons, quote, were and are all mad. This included their choice of wives, and Gordon's mother was famous in Edinburgh for galloping madly down High Street on the back of a capering pig. Now, Adam, you're from Edinburgh. Comment, please.
Yeah, just another day in old Edinburgh town, really. it's a funny place, Edinburgh, yeah. Gordon is of Scots extraction. Doesn't he come off quite badly in Barnaby Rudge, David? Doesn't he come off as a bit of a...
He certainly does.
Which is, am I right? It's that and Tale of Two Cities are Dickens' only two historic novels.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I don't think Dickens condemns him utterly in Barnaby Rudge, but he, if I remember correctly, paints him out as being a bit of a. Bit of a dafty, but yeah, mad, did you say? There's insanity in the bloodline.
Yeah, that's right. Well, where do you think the mother was going on the back of the pig?
Well, I imagine down to the palace, I would imagine. I imagine it would be easier to ride a pig down the High Street than up.
Uh-huh.
The castle's at the top end, and Holyrood Palace is at the bottom. I think it strikes you at first as an unusual, the last thing you would expect to see in genteel old Edinburgh. But then it's a slightly closer examination. It's very much part of the fabric of the place because it's deemed to be quite a stiff place, Edinburgh. My pal Murphy, who's from the other place, that's Glasgow.
Uh-huh.
He says that you'll... You always have more fun at a Glasgow funeral than you do at an Edinburgh wedding. he would say that, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
But Edinburgh has this sort of veneer of respectability and sanity and being very much of the establishment. I suppose it's the most English city in Scotland.
Uh-huh.
It's maybe the most English city in Britain
uh-huh.
in many ways. But it's also the most Scottish city in the world at the same time. And that kind of duality, that sort of schizophrenia is absolutely in the geology of the place. It really is. It's in two pieces. It's Old Town and New Town. The New Town, very pleasingly, is 18th century. So when we say new, we're not going too mad.
Uh-huh.
And it's geometrical and beautiful. Squares and circus and... long streets and gardens, really crescents, really lovely, geometrical and graceful. And then the old town around the volcano, around the castle, is just higgledy-piggledy and sort of wild and like a maze, like a labyrinth. So you've got two parts of the city there. And the And once a year, well, for 11 months of the year, Edinburgh is quite sedate.
Uh-huh.
But then every August, when things are back to normal, you know, the genteel old lady jumps up on the table and dances a can-can and shows us her drawers, you know, for the Edinburgh Festival. And it's, so, you know, for part of the year, Edinburgh is insane. It's completely off the wall and mad. And then in September, she goes back to her being
handsome. You don't suppose she was riding this poor pig to market, do you?
I wonder. It's so this is obviously in the day before the Edinburgh Festival is what I was thinking. The festival's 1948, I think. Maybe somebody will pick me up on that and correct me. But it's so before 1948, how did Edinburgh and the citizens of Edinburgh express their insanity? riding a pig down the high street, riding a pig right down the Royal Mile.
Yeah.
It's used to roll before we had the wildness of the Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah, and you're the wife of a lord. You're a lady. So, I mean, this is just another one to add to my baseball card collection of remarkable British women. I mean, you know, there's that one that who rides naked in Coventry, is that right? Godiva, Lady Godiva?
Lady Godiva, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Be brave to do it this May. I tell you what, ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening in from overseas, it's freezing here in London, Scott. Lady Godiva, another terrific tale there, isn't it?
I think
that kind of once in a while eccentricity is woven into the fabric of Edinburgh. I tell you who to chat to about Edinburgh is Ruth, our amazing genius geologist colleague, because it's a geological place, Edinburgh.
All right.
Volcanic.
Yeah.
And then it's the Enlightenment. So it's modernity and prehistory.
Uh huh.
Every way you cut Edinburgh, there's duality. So Jekyll and Hyde. No coincidence that, you know, the writer of that is an Edinburgh man.
Well, that phrase you just used, modernity and prehistory, that I think might be applicable to my second question, which has to do with sport. And in particular, what you call football, what I would call soccer, you know, I've just never understood it. I don't even know the offside rule, or is that the right term? The offside rule.
You get a job as a referee.
but what I really don't understand is London has, I don't know, is it 8, 9, 10? Premiership teams in, you know, the biggest American cities, you know, Chicago, New York, they have two. And those clubs are called the Chicago Cubs and the Chicago White Sox, or the New York Yankees and the New York Jets. But they're not called London Spurs. So first of all, I don't get that. And secondly, this thing that happened about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I really didn't understand that at all. And what's brought all this to mind is this morning in the papers, Manchester United is, I think, playing tonight for some trophy, et cetera, et cetera. But I really did not understand this business about, was it a Super League that was they were trying to form and it all? Can you talk about that? You know what I'm referring to. Can you?
Yes, I do. Yeah, there's a lot in there. I think, can I first of all make a grammatical observation?
Uh-huh.
Even if your accent was absent, your grammar would reveal your that you were from North America when you said quite correctly, grammatically correctly, Manchester United is playing this evening, which is a typically American thing to say. You know, we would say Manchester United are playing, which is grammatically incorrect, but it's part of the idiom of football.
Can you drill down into that?
I don't know why that is. I remember years and years ago, I had a book out about Scottish football trivia, and I took a mad turn.
Uh-huh.
He wrote it all with the American grammar of, you know, Rangers is the team that has won the most Scottish championships, that sort of thing. And the editor got back in touch with me saying, have you gone mad? Why have you done this? Uh-huh. Why have you done this kind of American grammar? And so I had to go back through the whole book and change it back to the grammatically incorrect British football idiom of Manchester United are the biggest team in England.
I'm going to hazard a far-fetched guess here. Only 8% of us are of English extraction, or maybe British extraction. The single largest group is German. It's 15 or 16%. And this New York, Manchester United is there something regimented and Teutonic and orderly, a team all working together, they're one unit, whereas there's something sort of Celtic and going in all sorts of different directions with the plural verb are. Does that make any sense at all?
Why not? Yes, and let's not lose sight of the fact that it is correct as well. Manchester United is.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's quite an interesting idea. Yeah, there's playing as a team. Well, I suppose it depends. You know what your team is, who your team are. Sometimes they don't necessarily play as a unit.
Uh huh.
And it's an unusual situation that we've had with this Super League, breakaway Super League. Big teams in England, big teams in Italy and Spain breaking away to form this Super League, which failed, which floundered.
First of all, Adam, did people see that coming or did that come out of the blue?
Do you know, it's been in the ether for 50 years. Around the time that, from just before the time that the Super Bowl is founded. Am I right? That's 68, 69?
It was back in the 60s. I can't remember exactly when. Yeah.
I can't remember who won it then. Some shower from Wisconsin.
Touché.
The discussion in the post-war period was kind of that. The economics of having, in London, 12 teams, in Manchester and Liverpool, 2 teams each, in Edinburgh, 2 teams. The economics of that were, being questioned. And there was talk of an amalgamation. And in my own hometown in the 1980s, in Edinburgh, Heart of Midlothian, a team named after a Walter Scott novel, they sought to buy up and amalgamate with Hibernian, my own team, the romantic name for Ireland. And that was hugely, hugely unpopular to try and amalgamate these two teams for business reasons. And it didn't take place, it didn't occur. And both teams now are still, plying their own furrow. Economically, I suppose, in a small city like Edinburgh, then it would make sense to have one team. But it's about more than economics. It's about sort of heritage and identity, I think. The Heart of Midlothian, for example, are the team of the Protestant establishment of Edinburgh, and Hibernian are the team of the Irish immigrants. And so there's an identity there. And so that was one of the big problems with this Super League thing, the idea that all to do with making money and all to do with big business. Taking those teams out of, the English teams out of the English League and the Spanish and the Italians out of their leagues to compete for a television audience. To compete before a television audience, it was felt that the grassroots fans were being cut out of the game. Mm-hmm. But as I say, I think it's been coming for 50 years, and I think at some point in the next 20 or 30, it will happen. I'm against it, I have to say, but it seems to be the way the wind's blowing. It seems to be that kind of American model of a franchise, turning these institutions into franchises and uprooting them and moving them around if need be to go where the money is. go where the money can be made.
Who was that famous Irish player? He was, what you call it, a midfielder? Did he talk about fans eating prawn sandwiches or something like that? What was his term?
It's Roy Keane.
Yeah.
Roy. We get some terrific examples of terrific new phrases from football. The guys who go into football are not necessarily of a background where they've been educated, and neither do they need to be. But when they enter into the arena of sort of commentating and speaking on television, we get these wonderful phrases, such as Roy Keane describing corporate supporters as the prawn sandwich eaters. You know, they would rather have a free prawn sandwich in hospitality than watch the game. And these phrases are often really, really vivid phrases, uh-huh. And that's a really good example. So, yeah, the corporate boxes at these big clubs bring in a lot of money. And so the audience has changed for football in the last 40 years, since the 80s.
Uh-huh.
And it's a much more middle-class, sit-down, bring-the-family audience, whereas before it was a crowd.
Uh-huh.
Stand up, and it was very much a working class game. So I think all these changes towards the Super League have been coming for quite a few years, with the demographic shift in the people who are watching football.
But the man in the street, the little man, saw off the wealthy owners this time. Is that right?
Yes, it was headed off the whole affair. I don't think it was popular anywhere. I wonder how popular it was in Spain, for example, because there's a huge identity thing going on there with Barcelona were part of the whole thing, and they're the representative of the Catalans. It was the only place where Franco couldn't stop them speaking Catalan was inside the stadium. Real Madrid were Franco's team, so you've got a whole, got war there, uh-huh, as well. So I wonder how they felt in Barcelona with the team being uprooted from their situation. Traditionally, Man United, not even so much traditionally, but in the post-war period when they were struggling and they were taken over by, the manager, Matt Busby, a Scot and a former Man City player, he took them over. And to get them, to get the crowds boosted, he was a daily communicant, Matt Busby, a practicing Roman Catholic. And so he went to the local Catholic schools and churches and offered, deals to get people in through the turnstiles. And so they became quite greatly associated with the Catholic community,
uh-huh,
in Manchester, the Irish Catholic community. And City, in fact, they even have the livery of the city on their badge, the city of Manchester. So they're more the team of the English Protestant,
uh-huh,
certainly in the post-war period. So that's an identity thing as well. But people tend to, it's an interesting idea, I think, to have an external organisation, an external thing that you can, identify with and give yourself another handle on the world,
uh-huh,
somehow. Sounds a bit nebulous, that, but I think that's a big part of being a football fan in this country, part of your identity, for better or for worse. And I think that's why the popular opinion was so against the whole Super League idea.
Yeah, yeah. Let me tell you, I've never admitted this to you, Adam, and this is a matter of spectacularly not reading the room. But when I came over here all those years ago and discovered that this country, the United Kingdom, fielded 4 different teams in these World Cup, Scotland and England and Wales and Northern Ireland, that didn't make any sense to me at all. You know, I thought, well, this is the United Kingdom. Why don't they just take the best players from England and the best players from Scotland and the best and play as one team? It just did not compute, and I'm sure that was a very. I'm beginning to get it now. Why that doesn't have legs? It's never going to have legs, is it?
Well, I tell you what, it's these days it's got English legs because the British team would have 11 English players. Because I'm sure that's been unkind to the Welsh, I don't know, but the Scotland isn't, you know, a number one sort of international team at the moment and haven't been for quite a while. But although they did qualify for the Euros this year, so well done, lads. Uh-huh. But do you know, right back in the beginning, in the 1860s, when football was starting to be codified and organised and set up into competitions and leagues, the Football Association was founded in London. And the reason why they're called the Football Association, because you've got the Football Association of Ireland, you've got the Welsh Football Association, the Scottish Football Association, and the Football Association, which is the English body. The reason they didn't call it the English Football Association was they were hoping that Queen's Park, the original big team in Glasgow, would join in.
Uh-huh.
The railways were just coming in mid 19th century, and so there was going to be ease of communication. The half day holiday. Now, exactly when that comes in, I'm not sure, but I can't remember. But, you know, the idea that working men, and it is in the period we're talking about only men, would have Saturday afternoon off. You'd finish at midday at your work, and then you would go to football.
Uh-huh.
So you've got a means of getting there with the railways. You've got a means of taking teams up and down the country. You've got a little pocket of time for fans to attend. And the Football Association's vision was that Queen's Park, the great Glasgow team, they would also take part in the thing. So that's why it was called the Football Association and not the English Football Association.
Uh-huh.
It didn't quite happen. Too big a distance back then. Glasgow to London, even Glasgow to Manchester was a long way back then. But the Football Association were so keen for Queen's Park, who are nicknamed the Spiders. They play in black and white. Queen's Park to take part, that they were given a bye in the FA Cup to the semi-final stage.
Huh.
They were given a free pass to the semi to the last four in this knockout competition to encourage interest and, you know, success. So, yeah, the original idea was to have a British Football Association, but it became immensely popular in all over the country.
Yeah.
I think there's just again the economics of it when it was first set up. There's very little question of teams being wealthy enough to travel up and down that length of the country back then.
I'm sure another important factor in all of this is that American melting pot thing. I mean, you know, don't do it. But if you were to move to the U.S. In 6 months, you'd be an American. You and I are never going to be English. I'm right about that, aren't I?
Sure. Down through the 19th and 20th century, a lot of Scots moved to England for work. And we had a great many, Preston North End are a very good example. Not a particularly successful side at the moment. But they were the first sort of great champions of England. They won the double, which used to be very difficult to do, to win the cup and the league in one season. And their nickname, they were the Scots professors, because they had so many genius Scots footballers in their ranks, but individuals. So the movement of players has always been a part of the game in Britain, in the United Kingdom.
Uh-huh.
But the movement of teams across the borders didn't ever catch on. Individual home nations having their own identity in football.
Here's a great London statistic that I've just discovered that I'm actually putting out on my Kensington walk. I read that in 1920, there were more Scots living in London than there were in Edinburgh, and there were more Irish people living in London than there were in Dublin.
That would make sense for all manner of economic and political reasons, certainly. Yeah, absolutely.
Now, I said, oh, can I have 15 minutes? And we're already gone way over that. What about the music stuff that's coming up, Adam, in June? Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, we've got, we're sort of bringing out the, it's the Rock and Roll London Pub Walk again. So we're out for a walk. I'm going to stop at the pub. It's going to be a bit of live music and history and trivia, all the usual stuff. But I've split it up into four different tours this year. So in the month of June, four Wednesdays on the bounce. We're going to do four different Rock and Roll London tours. So that's Rock and Roll Soho, Rock and Roll Covent Garden, Rock and Roll Marylebone and Fitzrovia. And the fourth one is Rock and Roll Mayfair and Soho again. And so the idea is it will build into what I'm pretty sure will be the most comprehensive history of rock and pop music in the West End ever done by a tour guide in London. And then we're going to do it again in July for if people have missed it. So, yeah, we're going to get into corners of the West End that we don't usually go to on a Wednesday night.
Fantastic. Adam, are there any pop stars that are going to figure in all four of them?
The Beatles,
they'll
figure in all four. In terms of roots music, we'll go back to Skiffle, the homemade blues influenced, folk influenced music that suited the rationing period after the Second World War. Homemade rock and roll, if you like. So we'll get into that. We'll get into a bit of jazz. We're gonna get into the sort of social history of the West End as well. So yeah, there's And indeed, right back to the 1660s, the origin of the place as an entertainment district. Yeah, there's a lot going on.
Well, that sounds great. And let's just go to the other end. I'll make this the last question. The other end of the spectrum, are there pop stars who just figure in one of those four neighborhoods?
Yeah, I think, for example, Bob Marley has a huge presence in West London. And in Brixton, but in our West End, he'll feature in the Covent Garden tour particularly, because we'll visit, and he won't pop up so much in the other tours, but we'll visit the Lyceum Theatre, where the Lion King is at the moment, and Bob Marley's version of, the live version of No Woman, No Cry that we typically hear most often on the radio in the olden days. Was recorded at the Lyceum here in London. So the Lyceum is where Bob Marley becomes an international superstar. So we'll deal with old Bob in Covent Garden, but not so much elsewhere.
And Adam, are you going to take the guitar and do that brave and astonishing and astonishingly brave thing, getting it out and strumming a few?
In short, yes, so you have been warned. That will either be a USP or a trigger. Head for the hills. If you don't like singing with guitar playing, then go to one of the other Wednesday night tours at walks.com. But if you like a bit of live music, I'll be doing that. Now, where that's going to happen, don't know. We're going to make that up as we go along. I know the route, I know the subject, and I'm well enough covered. If stuff comes up, then we can go into unexpected corners as well in terms of topic. But what with one thing and another, with, you know, pubs being less accessible, and, you know, we might not be able to get inside to do the live music, so I might have to do the live music in the street. So I'm not proud. Music al fresco.
Do I, by any chance, know the pub in Fitzrovia that you...
You do, yes. The pub in Fitzrovia is the King and Queen.
Yeah.
That's where we're going to head to. And we were there on Sunday with the London Walks Tour. Bob Dylan in London. His 80th birthday. There's a lovely cartoon doing the rounds the other day there. It's Schultz, Charles M. Schultz, one of America's greatest ever poets. And he 50 years ago, he put out a four-frame cartoon of Linus and Charlie Brown leaning on the fence, staring into the distance, and Linus says, "Do you know, Bob Dylan turns 30 today." And then there's an empty frame where they stare into the middle distance again. And then Charlie Brown replies, "That's the most depressing thing I've ever heard." And that was 50 years ago. He was 80 on Monday.
Yeah.
And we did a terrific walking tour, ending up at the King and Queen, which is where he first played in 1962 here in England.
We used to say back in the 60s, don't trust anybody over 30. And now I suppose it's don't trust anybody under 80.
Absolutely. Bob Dylan is 80 years old. And yeah. So, one of his great buddies, a guy called Martin Carthy, who's a hugely important English folk musician. He was 80 on Friday just past, so 2 days before Dylan, he turned 80. He taught Bob Dylan Scarborough Fair, for example, which Paul Simon also took on as well. So he's really, we'll talk about him. He's still up on his hind legs. He was doing a gig at the Wanstead Tap on Monday, 80 years old and still gigging.
Yeah. So on June 2nd, that's a Wednesday, at about 10 to 7, 5 to 7, you're going to be at Tottenham Court Road Tube Stop Exit 1. Is that right?
That's exactly where I'm going to be, holding up the famous white leaflet at London Walks. And we'll be off around Soho that night. Same place the next week. We'll be off around Covent Garden. Then for Marylebone, we're meeting at Baker Street.
And that's on the 16th, is that right?
16th. And then the 23rd will be at Bond Street to rake around Mayfair and find Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah. Well, whether you need one or not, you just might have a roadie along, I think.
Excellent. Well, you know where we are.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm looking forward to it. And as I say, we'll do it again in July.
Yeah.
So if you turn up for the third one in June and think, all right, okay, this is all right, I'd like to do the others, then you can just roll on into July. And so, yeah. So look forward to it.
And the weather's going to be good by then. So good stuff.
I haven't checked the weather forecast since November 2018, and I'm very proud of that. I feel like I've been unchained from a lunatic.
Yes.
They just look out the window, you know, at the BBC.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, thanks very much, Adam. I think this will probably go up tonight. So,
always a pleasure, never a chore. Thanks for having me, dude.
Just great. Thanks a lot.
Smashing.